If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Driven Economy, sfbu.edu. At 4 o'clock, it's KQED, San Francisco, KQEI, North Highland, Sacramento. Online, too, at kqed.org.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at progressive.com.
Turns out it's not what you know, but when you know it. Economy-wise, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the United States Postal Service, offering holiday postage stamps for purchase at checkout at over 40,000 participating supermarkets and drugstores, and at wholesale clubs Costco, Walmart, Sam's Club, and BJ's. And by JumpCloud, simplifying IT through its intelligent, unified AI-backed platform that securely connects users to any resource from any device anywhere. JumpCloud, helping organizations prepare for AI acceleration.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today. This one is the 8th of December, good as it always is to have you along, everybody. We're going to talk in a little bit about the Federal Reserve and what data it's going to be looking at tomorrow and Wednesday as it decides what to do with interest rates and why, in fact, it is meeting without the latest data. But we're going to start with the last best information the central bank is going to have to put into its models, the October count of job openings and layoffs. That'll be along for us tomorrow. Marketplace's Nova Safo gets us going today.
Here's what we know. Inflation has been stubbornly hanging around 2.8% for months. That's above the Federal Reserve's 2% target. Meanwhile, key areas of the labor market are showing signs of weakness, says Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute.
So if you look at, let's say, the black unemployment rate, that's been rising pretty steadily over the last few months. Young workers, their unemployment rate has been rising over the last year, almost 2 years.
She says that can indicate things to come for the broader labor market. For the October report on job openings due out tomorrow, Gould will look closely at the rate of new hires, which has been falling.
The hires rate is about where we were in the aftermath of the Great Recession. So think 2013, 2014, not a very strong economy.
But as we know, the labor market isn't the Federal Reserve's only concern. It also works to keep prices stable. And on that front, Aditya Babe of B of A Global Research says the Fed may soon have something new to worry about. And there's a wonky economic term for it, reflation.
In reflation, you have more money, and the risk is that everybody else has more money as well, and so that might drive prices up.
Where's all that money coming from? New tax breaks.
We're going to get $100 billion in consumer stimulus from the Big Beautiful Bill.
He's talking about tax cuts for workers who get overtime and on tips.
Roughly $65 billion is going to hit in the form of larger than expected tax refunds.
For now, the Federal Reserve appears more worried about the labor market, says Kyle Roda at Capital.com. He says a quarter point cut this week is all but certain.
I think the really critical issue at this Fed meeting is perhaps not so much if the Fed cuts or not, but it's the kind of color around the cut.
As in what Chair Jerome Powell says in the aftermath. This time, Rota expects to hear that a December cut doesn't mean a January cut. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Your homework assignment today, should you choose to accept it, is to look up a Supreme Court case from 1935 called Humphrey's Executor. The citation is 295 U.S. 602, if you're curious. It's about the president's ability to fire the people running independent agencies. And then check out the coverage of today's hearing in a case called Trump v. Slaughter, same topic. And as you read, just know that what's at issue here is almost literally how this economy works. Wall Street on this Monday, which is, again and forever, not the economy. Traders were a little bit cranky. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As Nova was just telling us, members of the Federal Open Market Committee start their two-day meeting tomorrow, despite having little recent data on this economy. So why not, and this is a totally serious question, why not just wait and reschedule until data does come out? Catherine Ann Edwards is an economist. She's also the host of the Optimist Economy podcast. Catherine, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Tick through for me, would you, the information that Jay Powell and the gang have as they head into this meeting?
Not much. We are not going to have data on the month of October, and they will not have ever. No one will ever have that. Yeah. And we won't have November data. It'll come out a couple weeks after the meeting. So the last piece of information they will have is September.
This seems like a very common sense question, but things, you know, at the level of the economy are rarely common sense. Why doesn't Powell just come out and say, you know what? We have been saying forever. I have been saying forever. We need data. Austin Goolsbee, the president of the Chicago Fed, comes on this program all the time and says, I'm a data dog. I need some data, without that weird Southern accent. But you know what I mean? Why don't they just say, look, we're going to push this meeting 10 days. Maybe the markets would like freak out a little bit, but I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a situation where it's a little bit damned if you do, damned if you don't. They would benefit from having more data, and I don't doubt that all of them want it. But at the same time, nothing about the fundamentals of our economy or our current economic situation have changed. And I think that they're, you know, one of the most important issues for the Fed right now is being able to maintain its independence. And I think they must have had some type of calculated decision to say it's more important that we make our schedule than to look like we're serving the whims of whatever is happening for the rest of government.
That's a guess.
Yeah. I'm not in the room.
Well, look, we're all guessing, right?
We're all guessing.
Yeah. Last thing, and then I'll let you go. This is one of those meetings where we're going to get the dot plot, the summary of economic projections, in which members of the Board of Governors and members of the Federal Open Market Committee and regional Fed presidents make their projections about where things are going to go. Some may recognize it as the dot plot. Those calculations are made based on models that they run with data in it. And so now we're going to have people saying, listen, this is where I think inflation is going to be at year end. This is where I think unemployment is going to be in 6 months. And yet the data is not there, right?
Well, not all of them are making projections on data. We know from the last dot plot that the most recent appointee to the Fed, who was still serving in the White House at the time, I mean, his dot plot was not even in the same neighborhood as everybody else's. Some of them are very data and model driven, and some of them are just opinion, and probably all of them are a little bit of intuition.
Right.
Again, I mean, yes, we live and die by data that comes out regularly, and it is on some level so horrible that we won't know the unemployment rate in October, the only month they've missed on record.
Like ever. Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's still that the threats to the economy are the same. And maybe there's a tenth of a point that they're missing, but they're not missing tariffs. They're not missing that unemployment and prices are both going up, even if they're going up at different, you know, small rates.
All right. Catherine Ann Edwards, she's an economist. She's also a podcaster. It's called the Optimist Economy Podcast. You should listen to it. Catherine, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks again for having me.
President Trump spent some time in front of the cameras today, as he is wont to do, and he said, among other things, that he's going to take $12 billion in tariff revenue and use it for farm relief. Tariffs, I am required to remind you here, are taxes paid by American businesses and consumers. Farmers, of course, have been among the groups most directly hit by the president's trade policies. The China soybean market, for example, has essentially evaporated, even as input costs for American farmers keep going up, and as Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall reports, they are making plans now for the 2026 planting season.
Fifth-generation farmer Jed Bauer grows corn and soybeans in southwest Ohio. I farm there with my wife and two kids. We're just under 1,100 acres.
Bauer and farmers he represents as head of the National Corn Growers Association have had a tough year.
Since China got out of the market buying soybeans, a lot of growers maybe switched more acres over to corn.
So much corn was grown that it drove down what farmers can sell it for, while the cost of farming stayed high.
It's our fertilizer costs, our chemical costs, our seed costs, and equipment costs.
Bauer says the Trump administration's aid package provides a short-term solution.
That's a Band-Aid. That won't help us long-term, but because we can't get these input prices to come back in line, that will help us get through planting season with some cash flow issues.
Longer-term relief could come through more stable trade relationships. LSU economist Michael Deliberto says soybean markets rallied in the fall when China agreed to buy U.S. soybeans again.
I think what every soybean producer is hoping for now is that China actually starts to follow through. And we are a little bit. Soybean sales have been made to China. And I think it's a step in the right direction to kind of put some of this trade uncertainty at ease.
But there's another country to consider that could affect the fortunes of U.S. farmers. Brazil. It continues to increase corn and soybean production, says Michael Langmeyer with Purdue.
That's going to impact the market for years to come because they just keep adding more supply to the market. And that's not a problem as long as world demand continues to increase.
But if economies like China's struggle, he says, that can weigh on global demand for these commodities. And that hurts U.S. farmers. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Unless there's some kind of breakthrough in Congress and a change of heart by the president, in some parts of this country, a lot of people who buy their own health insurance are going to feel more pain when Affordable Care Act subsidies go away in January. Those people, as it turns out, live in Republican-led states that didn't expand Medicaid to cover people who are working, but who were just above the poverty line. The subsidies were kind of a backdoor to get people covered who might qualify for Medicaid if they just moved across the state line. Now, though, millions of those people who would qualify for Medicaid elsewhere are staring at staggering premiums. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports.
Hundreds of cars are lined up in a high school parking lot in Hickman County, Tennessee. Crystal Tipton is driving one of them, waiting for a box of groceries from a local food pantry and reaching for a tissue.
I know you probably need to talk to somebody, so I'm afraid I'm going to get you sick.
She's hoping it's not the flu. But if Tipton needs to see a doctor, at least she has insurance coverage for now. She just received the dreaded letter from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. It told her that her plan on the Affordable Care Act marketplace is going from $50 a month to $350. There's no way. But what can she do?
I don't know yet. Pray. That's about all you can do is pray.
Because she's still going to need care. She manages diabetes and an autoimmune disease.
So I'm on certain medications that I have to have.
She's had to use the county health department before and expects that's where she'll be again. Tipton is one of 4 million Americans projected to lose coverage in the new year. It's not just because health insurance is getting more expensive, which it is. It's because generous subsidies implemented in 2021 are expiring. But that pain isn't evenly distributed. For states that didn't expand Medicaid, far more people took advantage of those subsidies. Nicole Rapfogel is a senior policy analyst with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
You have someone who has the same income in Tennessee as, you know, someone just across the border in Kentucky, North Carolina, Arkansas, Missouri, who just because they live on the other side of the border and they have a very low income, they're able to access Medicaid.
The expiring subsidies, Rapfogel says, leveled the playing field between states. Someone who could qualify for Medicaid elsewhere could even get a plan with no monthly premium. That quietly led to a surge in ACA marketplace signups that ballooned more than 200% in Texas, Georgia, and Tennessee. Mandy Spears of the Sycamore Institute, a policy research nonprofit, says the biggest jump, not surprisingly, was among those who would qualify for Medicaid in many states.
So these are folks that don't necessarily have a ton of money, and so they're going to be a lot more price sensitive.
Meaning many will just dump their coverage. In Tennessee, the uninsured rate is projected to jump by 40%. South Carolina and Mississippi could spike 50% or more. Healthcare economist Kara Smith of Belmont University says unless you're using your insurance all the time, it may not seem worth it.
That means people that on the margin are more healthy are going to drop out, leaving that community at a higher per person cost to provide coverage for them. And so it's just kind of a spiral. It's really concerning for us.
Smith calls it a double whammy because the people left behind will be more expensive to insure. They're folks like Kimberly Daft in Old Hickory, Tennessee, who can't afford to go without coverage.
I am at the doctor so much. I mean, I just got out of a 6-day hospital stay.
Being able to get insurance through the ACA marketplace allowed Daft to leave corporate America to start her own business selling specialty houseplants. Her subsidy is also going away, making her monthly premiums rise sevenfold. But she sees no option but to pay whatever it costs.
I'm never not going to be a sick person. I have to have access to good health care to stay alive.
For Daft, skimping on coverage is the last place she'd cut. So it's the rest of her budget that'll get a trim. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You don't really buy things nowadays without the intention to put it on your Instagram or your TikTok.
If you didn't post about it, did it even happen? Come on. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 215 points today, about 0.5%, 47,739. The NASDAQ down 32 points, about 0.1%. 23,545. The S&P 500 dipped 23 points, about a third of 1%, 6846 there. Paramount Skydance, as you perhaps heard, has come in with a hostile takeover bid for Warner Brothers Discovery worth $108 billion. That includes debt. Comes just days after Warner Brothers agreed to an $83 billion offer from Netflix. Perhaps you've heard about that in the press. It's been out there a little bit, that story. Maybe, perhaps. On Wall Street today, Paramount Skydance jumped 9%. Netflix slumped 3.4%. Warner Brothers Discovery grew about 4.4% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note went up. That's what happens. 4.16% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
The Numbers is supported by Mercury, a fintech that offers banking, credit cards, and financial software. Marketplace is supported by Ninja One, helping organizations manage, protect, and support every device and every user, all from one platform that automates IT and strengthens security. More at ninjaone.com.
Support for KQED on Marketplace comes from El Camino Health. Open enrollment happens once a year, more about which health plans provide access to El Camino Health doctors and nationally recognized hospitals at elcaminohealth.org/open enrollment. And Smuin's The Christmas Ballet. This joyful production features both classical ballet and contemporary numbers with new additions premiering alongside audience favorites. Now through December 28th, tickets at smuinballet.org.
Scientists have discovered millions and counting of new species on Earth since the 1700s. But how many more are there? The mission to better understand life on our own planet, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Underway at 4:30 here on KQED News. I'm Michael Staden for Sandy Althaus. 19 minutes after 4 o'clock on Marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are at the tail end of third quarter earnings season. Home builders among the industries yet to report. Toll Brothers comes out tomorrow. Lennar and KB Home next week. The latest Census Bureau data we have on housing construction is, well, first of all, it's old. It's from August. And also, it's not great. Building permits were down 11% from August a year ago. Actual housing starts down 6%. Why so bumpy, and are different times perhaps in the offing? Marketplace's Daniel Ackerman has more.
Builders started this year with a good deal of optimism, says Allie Wolf, chief economist with the housing data firm Zonda. Even with elevated interest rates, there seemed to be a lot of people who wanted to buy homes.
Going into 2025, builders were like, okay, the year's at least going to be good. Let's ramp up on new construction.
But come the spring selling season, those buyers just didn't turn up.
Builders found that they had a lot of standing inventory without consumers to buy those homes, so they have no incentive to build more homes if they couldn't sell the homes that they already had available.
Wolf says sales were slowed in part by relatively high mortgage rates. Those could tick down in the coming year, but the cost of building supplies may not, says Anibon Basu, CEO of Sage Policy Group, because the Trump administration has imposed tariffs on many of them.
Softwood lumber or copper, steel, aluminum.
Those import taxes have raised prices for the structure itself and the appliances that go in it. Basu says Trump's immigration crackdown is playing a role too.
If you look at the majority of our roofers in many communities, drywall hangers, painters, so on and so forth, they're immigrants.
And so the number of potential workers in the home building industry right now?
It's much smaller than the amount that we would need in order to be running at maximum efficiency.
Macrina Wilkins is senior research analyst with the Associated General Contractors of America. She says home building is also highly sensitive to borrowing costs. The Federal Reserve is expected to cut interest rates this week, but persistent inflation means those cuts may not continue. When you add it all up for home builders,
2026 has the potential to be better than 2025, but it does depend on whether or not financing costs ease.
Wilkins says demand for new housing will still be there. The question is whether builders will be able to meet it at a price buyers can afford. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
If you're even moderately engaged with pop culture, you're probably aware of Stanley Cups, those reusable water bottles everybody went nuts for a couple of years ago. Or Labubus, right? Those little dolls people are still a little crazy for. They have become status symbols, but the economics behind them says a whole lot about the state of the consumer economy today. Kendall Cunningham had the story in Vox. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I mentioned Labubus and those Stanley tumblers up in the introduction to our little chat here. What else are the big status symbols of the day?
I would say in addition to a lot of like the Pop Mart toys and the little trinkets that we're seeing, like Labubus, you also have Sunny Angels. You have all these water bottles like Stanley Cups and Owalas. Mm-hmm. The Trader Joe's micro tote bag is another like very cheap item that is becoming this like marker of status amongst Gen Z.
Sorry, and then a micro tote bag?
Yeah, it's like a $2 like mini tote bag. Wow. That's sort of like the size of a keychain that you attach to presumably another tote bag.
I am so not hip that I don't know what a micro tote bag is. Here's the thing about all these things and why we wanted to talk to you. Used to be that status symbols were to be bald about it. Expensive. And if you can get like a $2 keychain fob, and if you can get a Labubu, which costs, I don't know, like $30 maybe. I mean, how does that become a status symbol?
These products are usually limited products. A lot of companies like to use artificial scarcity to sell these products to make them seem a bit more special than they maybe are. And you also have these brands that are like very culty and sort of niche, and that adds this sort of coolness factor to these products. Labubus are a big example of that. The Trader Joe tote bag, which is again only $2. But it's very convenient for our times now because we're living in an affordability crisis. Yeah. A lot of Gen Z is not spending money on luxury goods. They're sort of reaching for things that are cheap but are also really flashy and attention grabbing.
Right. You mentioned Gen Z, and of course that's in the title of this piece. They don't, most of them, have a whole lot of money. So of necessity, it's the cheaper end stuff that becomes a status symbol. And they, of course, are more into social media, and that feeds into the whole thing. So there's a circularity here.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of questions of whether the popularity of these items are recession indicators. Yeah. The experts that I spoke to weren't totally convinced of that because I think people are sort of always willing to buy little trinkets. But the fact that they're being used as a way to attain like social media clout is a very, is sort of like the key part of this because they are pretty to look at. And they're very wearable. You know, my niece, for example, is very into all like the new water bottles and things like that. Uh-huh. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, you can just like have your water bottle sitting on your desk all day and people can like know you uh-huh. as the person who owns a Stanley Cup.
uh-huh. Yeah, no, I totally get that. I totally get that. Back up for a minute. Social media clout, part of the status of this thing is not just the having of it, but the displaying of it in a very public manner on social.
You know, I would say most things that Gen Z is reaching for, there's a bit of a show yeah. and tell element to it. You don't really buy things nowadays without the intention to put it on your Instagram or your TikTok. People want to see the latest, you know, iteration of something or like the different colored Labubus, how you dress them up and things like that. The monetary value doesn't matter right. as much as, you know, how cool it looks.
Right. And also, I imagine the journey, if you will, of actually getting one.
Yeah, that's another part of it. I feel like most people that I talk to about these items, there's always some sort of story to go along with mm-hmm. it. Like, oh, I had to stand in line for this amount of time, or I had to go on this many websites to find it. If you go on YouTube, you'll see a lot of vloggers have this own like subgenre of videos of, you know, I went to two Targets today to search for a Stanley Cup, or it's usually more than that. So it's also this experience that is tied to this cheap item.
Yeah. All right, put up or shut up. Do you partake in this phenomenon, or are you merely a disinterested observer?
Yeah, I'm definitely not like a huge compulsive shopper, so I'm more of a witness to it. I wrote another article about the sort of lipstick effect happening very literally with lip gloss, and I will say that I did participate with buying that, but that's about it.
You know, you got to do what you got to do. I myself am going in search of a Trader Joe's mini tote bag right now. You know, so yeah. to each his own.
They're $2. So why not?
$2. Kendall Cunningham at Vox. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Marketplace is supported by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
This final note on the way out today, a quick nod to the Chinese economy. Beijing announced today its trade surplus topped $1 trillion last year. That is, it sold $1 trillion more stuff overseas than it bought. The number says a whole lot about the domestic challenges of the Chinese economy. But here is the U.S.-facing data point. Shipments to the United States fell almost 29% year over year. Wonder what's going on there, huh? Amir Bibawi, Kayla Nash, John Gordon, Noya Carr, Amanda Petra, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Kelly Silvera is the news director. And I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
I'm Brian Watt. When you support KQED, our local stories stay loud and clear. Join your neighbors in keeping public media strong. Give now at kqed.org/donate.
All things considered from NPR News on the way next. First, though, it's a Bay Area traffic update. Beginning in the South Bay, Julie Depish takes the wheel.
They're close to clearing that stall, southbound 280. It's before Guadalupe Parkway. Vehicle on the right shoulder now, but just partially blocking the right lane. So a little slow back to the 880-17 interchange. Got a wreck in Milpitas and South 880 after Dixon Landing Road. That's in the center divide, but now partially blocking the left lane. We do have a traffic alert for an entry crash, Antioch Bridge, heading northbound at the north end of the bridge. That lane is blocked. Traffic back to up to Wilbur Avenue. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Cover Up from Citizen Ford director Laura Poitras. With access to notes from reporter Seymour Hirsch, this documentary captures the process and power of investigative journalism. On Netflix, December 26th. Awards eligible.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Republican lawmakers have spent months of falling in line with the president on tariffs and spending.
But now some are trying to prove their independence from Trump.
There was a lot of fear about what he could do to you electorally. That's diminishing.
Those stories and more coming up after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Trump administration is considering rolling back changes to how the federal government produces statistics about race and ethnicity that are often used to redraw voting maps and enforce civil rights laws. NPR's Hansi Luong tells us the changes were approved during the Biden administration.
The 2030 census and other future federal forms have been set to ask about race and ethnicity in one question instead of separating the two while allowing people to check more than one box. And there are supposed to be two new checkboxes, one for Hispanic or Latino and another for Middle Eastern or North African, a category the U.S. government would no longer automatically classify as white. Research suggests that could allow many people of MENA descent and Latinos to more accurately report their identities. But at a meeting of federal statistical agencies in Washington, D.C., Mark Calabria of the White House's Office of Management and Budget said the Trump administration is now reviewing these planned changes. It's a move the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, has called for in its Project 2025 action plan. Hansi Luong, NPR News.
Well, it turns out the studios that brought you Casablanca, Harry Potter, Batman may still be in play. Netflix struck a deal last week to buy Warner Brothers Studio and HBO, but now NPR's David Folkenflik tells us Paramount is upping its bid to $108 billion for all of the company.
Paramount chief David Ellison says he believes deeply in the future of movies and entertainment, but Ellison says Paramount needs Warner Brothers to take on Netflix and Amazon and Apple and Disney. Netflix is already the biggest streamer. President Trump said Sunday he'd be involved in reviewing any deal. Ellison has built warm ties with Trump, and Trump cheered the changes made at CBS News since Ellison acquired it this summer. Though, you never do know how that will end up. On Sunday, CBS's 60 Minutes interviewed a critic of Trump. On Monday morning, Trump wrote that CBS is worse than ever before under Paramount's new owners.
You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. The West Contra Costa Unified School District's teachers' strike is on its third day today, but the picket lines are smaller than last week. That's after district support staff, represented by the Teamsters Union, reached a tentative agreement with the district yesterday that includes raises and fully paid health benefits by 2026. For teachers, the stalemate continues. Union leaders accuse the district of ghosting them in negotiations, while the district says it's reviewing the union's latest proposal and has invited them to meet tomorrow. Christina Baronian is a teacher at Lake Elementary.
Right? Just to correct the record for anyone thinks this is just about us. No, this is about the students, because the teachers' working conditions are the students' learning condition.
State Superintendent Tony Thurman says he's monitoring the situation and is urging a resolution. Prosecutors are representing their final arguments today in the murder trial of filmmaker Kevin Epps, who's accused of killing a homeless man with ties to his family. KQED's Sarah Hosseini reports from San Francisco's Hall of Justice.
Epps' defense team argued inconsistencies in the testimony from Epps' then-sister-in-law, Star Gull, who was in the house when they say Epps shot her former husband, Marcus Polk, in self-defense back in 2016. They also pressed the lead investigator on the case, Alan Leaving, referencing next-day interview transcripts with Gull, in which she says she told Polk to leave while she was inside as well as outside the house. Levy described Gull as traumatized. I'm Sarah Hosseini, KQED News.
And I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from Oakland San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for KQED comes from Devils and Details, a Duke Magazine podcast. Listeners can explore, made for this, Blue Chair Conversations, featuring candid interviews with Duke Changemakers, and What Inspires Them, available across podcast platforms. Perkins Coie LLP, a legal advisor to established and frontier technology companies in the Bay Area and across the globe. Learn more at PerkinsCoie.com. And Postman, used by over 40 million developers, Postman offers a platform where teams build APIs to help AI agents and humans make smarter decisions from design to delivery. More information at postman.com. Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters this Friday. And Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And support comes from listeners like you of KQED News. All Things Considered, underway at 4:36.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Republican-controlled House and Senate have not done much to stand in the way of President Trump, even when his actions have encroached on terrain that the Constitution reserves for them. But as NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass reports, there are signs that some Republican lawmakers are trying to reassert their independence.
When news broke last week that the Pentagon carried out a second strike on two individuals on a largely destroyed alleged drug boat in the Caribbean Sea, even some Republicans expressed alarm.
Somebody made a horrible decision. Somebody needs to be held accountable.
That's North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis.
This is our job. This is part of our oversight. That's pretty straightforward.
The strikes are not the only actions that have spurred a handful of Republicans to express a little daylight with the Trump administration. Some have criticized Trump's tariffs.
Our lobstermen, our blueberry growers, our potato farmers will pay the price.
Inaction on expiring health subsidies.
We are looking at a massive crisis unless Congress acts. And
a proposed Ukraine peace plan.
It's not conservative to appease Putin, nor is it conservative to have a lack of moral clarity who's at fault at this war.
Trump's push to eliminate the filibuster.
You'd have to be smoking wizard weed to vote for that.
And his reluctance to release the Epstein files.
And he called me a traitor for standing with these women.
That was Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, before her Senator John Kennedy, Congressman Don Bacon, and Senators Josh Hawley and Susan Collins. After months of the White House steamrolling Congress on tariffs, appropriations, and military intervention, even this careful pushback is a departure, says former Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona. He says the shift is accelerating with Trump's declining approval rating and after Republicans' poor performance in off-year elections last month.
There was a lot of fear about what he could do to you electorally. That's diminishing.
Flake, who did not run for re-election in 2018 in part because he refused to unconditionally back Trump, says some lawmakers are now more willing to say aloud what they long expressed behind closed doors.
Obviously, it's behind the scenes. It's a whole different ballgame.
But this is not the first time observers declared a new era, only for Trump to firm up his grip on congressional Republicans. For example, after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol.
Yeah, that is a fair point. I think a lot of us have been wrong on how long this has endured.
And most Republicans vocalizing their disagreements are retiring, represent competitive congressional districts, or are perennial moderates. One of those centrists, Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, says Congress has made some recent attempts to push back on the White House, like resolutions on tariffs and boat strikes, but they haven't been successful or sufficient.
I'd like to see more myself. And believe that if we don't stand up for our powers under the Constitution, nobody else will.
The framers gave Congress the power to appropriate funds, to declare war, and levy taxes, like tariffs. Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune says it's unfair to say this Congress has relinquished its authority as an independent, co-equal branch.
I don't know how much different this one is. A lot of times, if I have differences with the administration, I don't litigate them in public. But we do have a responsibility, I think, as partners to try and get an agenda done for the American people that they voted for.
Molly Reynolds, an expert on Congress at the nonpartisan Brookings Institution, says it's true this is not just a Trump-era phenomenon. Congress has been ceding power to the executive and judicial branches for decades.
And in some cases, Congress has been
a willing and eager participant in sacrificing its own power to the other branches.
Reynolds says this did not start with Trump's willingness to act more unilaterally in his second term, but it did escalate the trend. Speaker Mike Johnson recently told the Katie Miller podcast that, quote, "We have this joke that I'm not really a Speaker of the House." Reynolds says there is precedent for Congress taking steps to reassert its authority, like the Watergate-era reforms that reined in the power of the president.
It was in a really different political moment than the one that we're living in now.
For one, the parties are more polarized. So Reynolds says it would be hard to envision a similar drive in Congress now to reassert power. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Jillian Klein. In 2015, Klein was diagnosed with breast cancer. She was 28 years old and months away from getting married. The very next day, she realized that it was the last day of open enrollment at her workplace. Usually, she just let her health insurance roll over, but now she suddenly had to decide if her plan would be enough to cover all the expenses that would come with cancer treatment.
It was all so overwhelming, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't understand copays or deductibles, but I did know that not having the right plan could be devastating. So I called Alex Mackey, the HR team member in charge of benefits. I didn't know Alex very well at this point. We were work friendly, but we weren't close. And yet she was going to be the first person outside of my parents and my fiance that I was about to tell what was happening. I was not ready to say the words, "I have cancer," but I had no choice. So I told Alex. She said, "Don't worry about a thing. I'll make sure you're enrolled in the right plan. Don't think about this again." And from that moment on, she became an unbelievable source of support. She got me enrolled in the right insurance plan. She set me up with a health advocate through the insurance company, something I didn't even know existed. And then she sat in on every call and reviewed every bill I received. She found miscodings, overbillings, double charges, and she taught me, most importantly, not to pay the first bill that I get because they're often incorrect. It's actually better to wait. She was with me, my mother, and another friend when I shaved my head and got fitted for a wig. She prepared a care package for me before I started chemo, and then she would text me on chemo days, and her messages, they were always perfect and just what I needed. Before cancer, I used to confuse being nice with being kind, and I didn't know the difference. But through this experience, I came to understand true kindness. Alex showed emotional intelligence that astounded me. She seemed to know the exact right thing to do, the exact right thing to say at each moment. Even in the middle of everything I was going through, I was in awe of her. And I think back on that time and I think about Alex when someone's in crisis or experiencing a tragedy, and I ask myself, what would Alex do?
Listener Jillian Klein of Bethesda, Maryland, honoring her unsung hero, Alex Mackey. Klein just celebrated her 10-year anniversary of being cancer-free. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. You ever notice how, as humans, we can be so confident until romance enters the picture, and then we get so weird?
Romantic relationships can sort of ignite anxiety in us, even if we don't necessarily have anxiety in other aspects of our lives. And I also think just being in relation with another person can be really confusing.
Uh-huh. That's Allison Raskin, a mental health advocate and author of the book Overthinking About You. She spoke with Marielle Segata, host of NPR's Life Kit. Here's Marielle.
Many of us have been taught that we'll have all of our physical, emotional, and social needs met by our soulmate or romantic partner. You know, the one. And if you think about it that way, a date feels like an audition for the role of your everything. No pressure, right? Allison Raskin says one way to protect your mental health while dating is to keep it in perspective and really interrogate some of the things you believe.
Because if you believe that one rejection off of a dating app means you're never going to find anybody and that you're completely unlovable and you're going to be alone forever, then engaging with the dating app is a really high-stakes activity.
So, okay, we're keeping things in perspective. She says it also helps to remember that dating is not a game where there are winners and losers. A date is just an opportunity to get to know another person and ask, are we a fit?
So it's not that I'm better than you or you're better than me. It's, is there something between the two of us that is worth building on? And so then if you have something not work out, it's not because you're the worst or they're the worst even. It's that you weren't able to get there together.
Another suggestion, Allison says, if you're someone who tends to overthink things or move too quickly in the early stages of dating, you might consider dating multiple people at once.
You know, I definitely had a history of that where I'd have one date and I would like be planning our wedding in my head. And that would put a lot of pressure on the relationship. And so I think it can be useful to sort of keep things open, to not put all your eggs in one basket, and to let things progress maybe at a more neutral speed than your speed, or, you know, like a balance between the two of your speeds.
Of course, you'll want to communicate that with the folks you're seeing, especially if you're being physically intimate. Make sure you're on the same page about whether you're exclusive. Another maybe surprising tip from Allison, you don't have to share every detail of your dating life with your friends.
When we do that, it becomes really important in our brain because we're talking about it all of the time. But if we can take a step back and instead say, I'm not really going to share until this is something worth sharing, then in our brain, it's like, oh, okay, the stakes of this first date aren't astronomical because I haven't told 15 people about it.
All right, so let's say the first couple dates work out and now you're in a romantic entanglement. How can you figure out if it's mentally healthy for you? Allison says one indicator.
If you like the person that you are when you're around them. So I'm making my funniest jokes. I'm sharing my most insightful thoughts. I'm my full self. So really looking at, like, who are you when you're with this person? What side of you do they bring out?
If, on the other hand, they consistently bring out your fearful side or your insecure side, or you just feel ill at ease after spending time with them, that's information. And maybe it tells you to keep playing the field. For NPR News, I'm Marielle Segarra.
For more tips and life hacks from Life Kit, go to npr.org/lifekit. This is NPR News.
When a student, Bennett Cook, recorded the ambient sounds and found something surprising, this resulted in a podcast about transit sounds like trains and beeping, honking horns, perhaps angry commuters. That story is among the stories ahead on All Things Considered. Here on KQED News, I'm Michael State in for Sandy Althaus. Speaking of the commute and of transit, here's Julie Depesh.
And back to the Antioch Bridge, the entry crash. Been there a couple of hours heading northbound on the bridge. They do have that lane closed, but any minute should be opening up. Still the backup to Wilbur Avenue. Some trouble on the east shore of westbound 80, the off-ramp to the Albany exit. That's a two-vehicle wreck blocking the right lane on the ramp. And a couple of vehicles collided in Milpitas on south 880 after Dixon Landing Road. Center divide, but partially blocking the left lane. Julie Depesh for KQED.
Julie with the latest right before the top of the hour news. Traffic support comes from Shanyun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Post Peninsula Open Space Trust. Post has protected and cared for more than 93,000 acres of open space on the peninsula and in the South Bay for the benefit of all. Learn more at openspacetrust.org. Visitorscoverage.com. a marketplace for travel insurance helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at visitorscoverage.com.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, in California, mobile homes make up between 4 and 6% of the housing stock, and they play a critical role in creating affordable housing. New state laws and efforts by for-profit developers to buy up mobile home communities are putting this kind of housing at risk. We're going to talk to experts about the challenges that mobile homeowners face. That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. From the Colorado Rockies to the redwood forests of California, there are millions of acres of land, forests, grasslands, desert, and tundra, managed by the government. Much of this public land is under the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Land Management in the U.S. Forest Service. It's also a vast expanse of territory that ranchers use for cattle grazing. In a recent investigation, reporters found that the wealthiest ranchers benefit most from these public lands. And they write that it's taxpayers who pick up the tab. We're joined now by investigative journalist Jimmy Tobias, one of the reporters who broke this story for High Country News. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Jimmy, I just want to start by asking you briefly about the history. How did the system come about of government permits to graze on public land?
Yeah, it was born out of the New Deal era, really, as these Depression-era dust storms kind of rolled over the Great Plains. Franklin Roosevelt and his administration signed into law the Taylor Grazing Act that sort of erected this public land grazing system in which ranchers are provided with 10-year permits to access these vast landscapes of the West at very low cost.
So grazing on public land is like a lot cheaper than on private land. You say in your piece that it's about 98% cheaper. Why hasn't the government brought up the prices?
That's a great question. Yeah, in essence, ranchers pay about $1.35 to feed a cow and a calf on public lands for a month. That low figure has barely changed in decades. So like industry-wide, the $21 million collected from ranchers by the BLM and Forest Service last year was about $284 million below market rate for grazing forage last year. And, you know, there have occasionally been efforts to bump the grazing fees, but often there's political pushback. And so this is endured, and really this program is a very large subsidy to public lands ranchers.
In your piece, you list some really high-profile billionaire ranchers, people like Murdoch, Rockefeller, household names we all know. How do they benefit from the system?
Yeah, well, you know, the program was kind of built in the New Deal era to support, I think, in general, smaller ranchers. But in this day and age, many of the largest ranchers are corporations, agribusinesses, or billionaires like the ones you mentioned. And they benefit because in addition to those very low costs of grazing, you know, there are also all these subsidy programs, things like drought and disaster relief, funds for range improvements, reimbursements if their livestock are preyed on by wolves or cougars. And we calculated that in 2024, the federal government poured at least $2.5 billion into subsidy programs that public lands ranchers can access. And in many parts of the country, you know, it's also causing significant environmental degradation.
So I know that you reached out to ranchers, big and small, over the course of your reporting. What did you hear from them?
Yeah, we heard a wide range of things. I mean, one of the things we heard is that, you know, it's often very costly and difficult to, you know, implement the best sort of environmental protection measures because of the economic pressures they face. We also heard that, you know, many of the smaller ranchers would likely go out of business if they weren't able to access some of these subsidies. You know, we also heard questions about whether some of these wealthiest ranchers should be getting subsidized.
You write that the Trump administration plans to make this ranching permit system more generous, so opening up even more acreage. And I know that you reached out to the Trump administration, you're reporting. What did they have to say about the system?
You know, they didn't really provide a lot of substantive comment. But again, we were able to access public records and look into the political appointees who are sort of shaping policy. You know, one of the most influential political figures at the Interior Department, which oversees much of this public lands grazing, is herself a rancher and a very prominent attorney for ranching groups. And they've spent a lot of their time, you know, the administration has spent a lot of its time this first year rolling back conservation rules that the public lands ranching industry opposes.
Jimmy, based on your reporting, where do you see the system headed?
Most likely, it's going to sort of remain in gridlock as it has. But I think it's important for the public to understand, you know, the face of the system today, that it is disproportionately benefiting some of these really large or wealthy ranchers, and that it's causing significant environmental degradation in many parts of the West. Those are issues that I think the taxpayers should know about, because they're on the hook for this program at the end of the day.
Jimmy Tobias is an investigative journalist and one of the co-authors of a new piece for High Country News and ProPublica. It's called The Wealthy Profit from Public Lands and Taxpayers Pick Up the Tab. Thanks so much, Jimmy.
Thank you.
What do you hear during your commute? Many of us are popping in headphones, maybe even listening to NPR, but one train enthusiast in New York listens to the world around him. When he was a student at Buffalo State University, Bennett Cook recorded the ambient sounds and found something surprising. His resulting podcast, a finalist in NPR's College Podcast Challenge, may change the way that you hear your commute. Here's an excerpt from his entry, Transit Sounds.
I have recently discovered a few subways that actually make music when they are leaving the station. The first subway is the Montreal Metro MR63. When this train leaves or arrives at different stations, the sound of a cello arises from the metro. Feel free to close your eyes and listen to this audio clip. Call me crazy, but if you listen really carefully and deeply, you can hear this instrument in the metro during the acceleration. All you cello musicians out there, consider this your challenge to match the tune heard from the metro itself. The next subway in the musical category is Boston, in which the music there is the door chime. When the doors close, the sound of a wooden xylophone arises, but there is also a violin that arises from the train as it leaves the station. Adding to that point, the tune you'll hear is a very tiny snippet of a song by Etta James called At Last. Take a listen. Did you hear that? Did you hear Etta's violins? Today, I have touched upon just two examples of the many that are waiting to be discovered by you, the listener, like the organs of the Senate subway of Washington, D.C. in the White House, the violins of both the Barcelona Metro 4000 or the Madrid Metro 3400 series. Isn't it fascinating that if you listen carefully and pay close attention, you will find music in the most unexpected places? For me, I was pleasantly surprised to find music underground, complementing my passion of transit. So the next time you leave your home, keep your ears open, and you too will be surprised to discover what the sounds of life have to offer.
That was an excerpt from Transit Sounds by Bennett Cook, who was a finalist in the 2021 NPR College Podcast Challenge. He has since graduated from Buffalo State and recently accepted a job at, surprise, surprise, the Chicago Transit Authority to work on trains.
Support for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge comes from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Where support for NPR comes from your part-time controller specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. Heifer International, where people can donate animal gifts to families living in poverty. Whether it's a goat, chicken, or cow, each gift is intended to help families earn a sustainable income. Heifer.org/NPR. And Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at Progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And support comes from listeners like you of KQED News. Checking the San Leandro commute at this hour at 4:59, here's Julie Depish.
It's a new crash on South 880. It's right before the 238 interchange. You'll see an SUV and a pickup truck over on the right-hand shoulder. Just a minor crash, Milpitas, on South 880 after Dixon Landy Road. Two vehicles involved. They're in the center divide. Bay Bridge Toll Plaza, the metering lights remain off. We do have a high wind advisory now and brake lights between the island and 101. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Thank you, Julie. Traffic support comes from Gleim, the jeweler. Support for KQED comes from Kaiser Permanente, where their doctors, hospitals, and health plans are designed to work together to help their members live healthy lives. Kaiser Permanente, a better idea for health care. The Weather Service says to expect Thule fog and stratus to return tonight for Bay Area valleys. The meteorologists say it's going to be quiet and benign weather conditions this week.